This recording is produced by the Reverend Eugene H. Maley, who is Professor of Sacred Scriptures at Mount St. Mary Seminary, Cincinnati, Ohio, and also the editor of the periodical The Bible Today. The title of his talk is The Biblical View of History. This record is copyrighted by the Catholic Biblical Association. No copies may be made without permission.
The Biblical View of History. Modern man has difficulties with the Bible. Almost all of them spring from a misunderstanding of the purpose for which the sacred authors wrote and of the literary forms they used to express their thought. The present talk is concerned with the first of these misunderstandings. It is an attempt to explore the purpose for which one particular inspired author wrote, or better, compiled his history of Israel. This investigation into the meaning of history as viewed by this one author will also help in our understanding of the history of the rest of the Bible, since the faith in the one God which determined this one view of history was basically the same faith for all the inspired writers. The term history can refer simply to events of the past, and it will be used in that sense frequently in this discussion. It can more properly be used to indicate the interpretation of events and of their unity, and it is with this sense that we are primarily concerned here. Since the biblical interpretation of history is unique among the peoples of the ancient Near East, it should prove helpful to consider, first of all, the historical outlook of Israel's contemporaries. Their concept will provide a striking contrast to the concept of the inspired author of the Old Testament. The gods of primitive man were generally associated with the phenomena of nature, and usually with those phenomena whose more awesome aspects, eternally manifested, impressed the primitive mind as being expressive of divine qualities. For example, the reoccurring rainstorm was seen as the reflection of the storm god, the mighty river as the river god, and so on. In other words, the earthly reality was for them a reflection of the heavenly reality. And so, by the observation of the earthly phenomena, they were able to create their heavenly pantheon. By the same means, these people were also able to determine the various activities of their gods. What happens in nature must happen, they reasoned, because the gods themselves so act. The apparent death of nature in the autumn of the year must be caused by the death of the god of nature, and its regeneration in spring was similarly attributed to the divine regeneration. Now, since their reconstruction of the heavenly reality was based on those phenomena of nature which occurred with some regularity and which could thereby be examined with greater precision than those events which occurred only once, it is understandable that a greater emphasis was placed on the former, while the latter, that is, the once-for-all events, were practically ignored as being meaningless. The divine activity, consequently, was associated only with the eternally reoccurring event of nature. For much of this that we are talking about now, we are indebted to a great extent to Eliade's study in cosmos and history. But this activity of the gods was presumed to take place in a special kind of time that was not subject to human chronological calculations. In illo tempore, we would call it mythical time, but for the pagans, it was the sacred time. In this sacred time, there takes place, for example, that titanic struggle between the gods and the forces of chaos, which results in the ultimate victory of the former and in the eventual act of creation, which, it must be noted, was not considered to have taken place in historical time, but in that mythical period that is beyond natural reality. This act has its counterpart in the annual renewal of nature in the spring of the year. Again, in mythical or sacred time, there takes place the hieros gamos, or the sacred marriage, between two divine beings, which is the ultimate explanation of the fertility of the earth. In short, it was in this special time that all of those heroic deeds of the gods are enacted, which alone give an explanation to the recurring phenomena of nature, to the endless repetition of nature's cycles. Ancient man felt that he could reproduce this sacred time in his own life by ritual means. By the performance of a ritual act, or by giving ritual importance to any act which could be found to have a divine archetype, that is, an act that had been performed by the gods or heroes in the sacred mythical time, such as hunting, fishing, generation, war, sacrifice, etc., archaic man experienced this sacred time. His act coincided with the mythical act, and he thus reverted to the mythical epoch of the gods. Now he truly existed. Now he achieved the fullness of his being. Profane time, on the other hand, was that experienced by man in the performance of any other acts which had no divine archetype, for which, in other words, no mythical exemplar could be found. Such were especially those acts or events which took place only once and were not repeated. These had no real meaning. Man in this state was not really being, rather he was only becoming. Understandably, ancient man preferred the existence in mythical or sacred time and abhorred profane time. With this outlook on events, it is clear that primitive man could not conceive of any goal in history, any destiny that had not already been achieved. The goal of life, rather, consisted in preserving, as best he could, the status quo, which meant, in the last analysis, the preservation of the endless cycle of nature. Perhaps we can understand this whole process more clearly if we examine one of the most common ritual practices among the peoples of the ancient Near East, that is, the New Year festival. Although there were wide variations concerning the beginning of the new year and the actual length of the year, there was the common notion that each new year represented a complete regeneration of time, a repetition or reflection of the mythical act of creation. A new beginning was made through a victory over the forces of chaos, and the old time was abolished. Again, it is important for an understanding of this concept that we divest ourselves of our notion of creation as the act of a sovereign divine Lord who thereby inaugurated the beginning of historical time and the succession of events. In particular, we can note that in the celebration of this New Year festival, there was represented, first of all, the return to the primordial chaos that existed before the archetypal or mythical act of creation. This return was represented by the total subversion of order, in which laws were abolished, orgies of all kind were indulged in, slaves became masters, a carnival king was enthroned, the true king humiliated, and so on. And then the struggle between Tiamat, the mythical goddess of chaos, and Marduk, the creator god, took place in a ceremony in which several actors reactualized the passage from chaos to cosmos. Finally, the festival concluded with a hierogamy, or a sacred marriage, in which the true king performed the marriage act with a temple prostitute, thus symbolizing the regeneration of the cosmos and of time. In the course of the 12-day festival, the creation epic, that is the Enuma Elish, was solemnly recited in the temple, thus giving liturgical voice to the mythical drama being enacted. Even the Greeks, the greatest thinkers and the greatest historians of antiquity, shared this cyclic notion of time and history, although it was expressed, of course, in other ways. For them, the supreme reality was that which is immutable and eternal. Since motion and becoming obviously do not achieve this degree of reality, they could be conceived to approximate it only insofar as they are repeated. As one modern author has put it, the circular movement that ensures the maintenance of the same things by repeating them, by continually bringing back their return, is the most immediate, the most perfect, and hence the most nearly divine expression of that which, at the pinnacle of the hierarchy, is absolute immobility. According to the celebrated Platonic definition, time, which is determined and measured by the revolution of the celestial spheres, is the moving image of unmoving eternity, which it imitates by revolving in a circle. Consequently, all cosmic becoming, and in the same manner, the duration of this world of generation and corruption in which we live, will progress in a circle or in accordance with an indefinite succession of cycles, in the course of which the same reality is made, unmade, and remade, in conformity with an immutable law and immutable alterations. No event is unique, occurs once and for all. Rather, it has occurred, it occurs, and it will occur perpetually. The same individuals have appeared, appear, and reappear at every turn of the cycle upon itself. Cosmic duration is repetition and anacyclosis, or eternal return. This conception of time influenced the Greek historians in their presentation of events. Thus, Herodotus conceived of history in a cyclic manner. For him, as Lerwith observes, history shows a repetitive pattern, regulated by a cosmic law of compensation, mainly through nemesis, which time and again restores the equilibrium of the historico-natural forces. Even Thucydides, who undertook to describe accurately everything that had taken place, and was more concerned with the investigation of the actual pragmatic event, was possessed of the conviction that history is but a succession of political struggles, which occur and reoccur, since their final explanation is man himself, whose nature does not change. In neither of these historians is there a concept of an absolute value in single, once-for-all events, or of a final goal towards which all events are directed. We can best point out the contrast between this cyclic concept of history and the biblical concept by stating that, whereas the pagans saw meaning only in those events which were eternally repeated and which, for them, represented the divine or the eternal in history, the Hebrews saw meaning especially in those extraordinary events which occurred once for all, which were irreversible, and which were the result of the one God's definitive intervention in historical time. Through these irreversible interventions, God revealed his will. And each intervention was not a repetition of a divine archetype, but rather it was a completely new divine act, giving added meaning to the divine will and the divine plan. We shall see presently in detail how this was actually conceived in the Old Testament period. But we might remark here that the conviction of an absolute value given to individual events was retained, as we might suppose, in the New Testament, where the linear movement of history is seen to reach a climax. It is most explicitly stated when the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews tells us that Christ entered once for all, ephapax is the Greek word, into the holy place, and again that once for all, hapax, at the end of the ages, he has appeared for the destruction of sin by the sacrifice of himself. And finally, that Christ was offered once, hapax, to take away the sins of many. In other words, a definitive event achieved of definitive value, which was to mark essentially the whole future course of events. Man in the macrocosm had been saved by an historical act, and future history would consist in the successive application, again in definite divine interventions through grace, of the merits of that saving act to the microcosm of the human soul. Thus, modern history, too, in this view, has its positive value. Through the power of the Holy Spirit working in the church, there is taking place the gradual building up of the mystical body of Christ. Jean Danielou develops this idea in his book, The Lord of History. We must note that this absolute value given to single events in the biblical concept involves also the notion of an essential relationship between events. Events, in other words, enjoy a unity by reason of their relation to the objective intervention of the divine Lord of history. It is this characteristic of biblical history which differentiates the philosophy, or better, the theology of the Bible, from the existentialism of some modern-day philosophers, for whom the individual act of the free will of man has a total value, absolutely divorced from any objective plan or historical reality. The Bible, therefore, presents for the first time a new meaning to time and to the succession of events. No longer is history seen as an eternal return, but as a linear movement in which individual events successively reveal a divine plan gradually unfolded, and in the eschatological period of the future to be completely fulfilled. To show how the Bible does present this concept of history, we are in need of a source that is more than a mere chronicle of events, more than an objective presentation of the bare facts of history. What is needed is a work of history in the strict sense of that word, that is, an interpretation of the events as understood in their relation to one another, and in particular to the whole movement of which they form a part. Such a source is ready to hand in the Old Testament. It has been shown with convincing clarity that the historical books of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and the two books of Kings, which recount the story of the Israelites from the time of the conquest of the land of Canaan down to the Babylonian exile, were given their present form by an anonymous writer who lived at the end of the period envisioned, that is, at the time of the exile. He has been called the Deuteronomist because he is also the final author of the book of Deuteronomy, which served as an introduction to his great work of history. Although he has respected his ancient sources by incorporating them into his work, he has also given them a definite meaning, both by his arrangement of the material and especially by his own theological observations inserted from time to time. It is these observations, seen in the context of the events described, which constitute the basis of an analysis of his concept of history. When we examine this work and extract those passages which unmistakably bear the stamp of the Deuteronomist's creation, one thing becomes clear. He was a man who had very definite ideas on the meaning of events of the past. Men and events are judged not by a more or less, but by an either or. This is the observation of Gerhard von Rad, from whom we have borrowed much of what is said in the remainder of this talk. What was the starting point the divine intervention par excellence that served as the basis for such a definitive judgment on events. It must be recalled that the author was writing under the influence of two major events in Israel's history, the fall of the Northern Kingdom in 721 and the fall of the Judah in the south in 587 BC. It was in the light of this double catastrophe, which bespoke God's infallible judgment on his unfaithful people, that the author saw all the other stages of Israel's pre-exilic life. If this ultimate judgment of God was based on the infidelity of Israel, and this is expressly stated in his epilogue to the fall of the north in 2 Kings 17:7, then all preceding reverses in her history must find their explanation in similar instances of infidelity to God. And this too is abundantly clear from an examination of the various books which constitute that history. The author proposes a theology of history that finds expression at every turn, and nowhere more starkly than in the second chapter of the book of Judges. But if infidelity brought reverses, then fidelity to God must bring a corresponding rise in fortune. And again, we find this expressly stated when, for example, the writer, having praised the loyalty of Ezekiah to the Lord, adds that the Lord was with him. In all his ventures he prospered. But fidelity or infidelity to God is a subjective element and cannot, of itself at least, be the ultimate determinant of historical events for one who is convinced of an objective norm. The only objective element to which everything must be referred is, for our historian, the law of God. This law, once pronounced on Sinai, becomes the unique criterion by which men are judged, and these judgments, either saving or condemning, become in turn the infallible expressions of the ensuing good or evil for Israel. History, then, in the last analysis, is created by the irreversible divine intervention in the legal proclamation. Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God, so that the Lord rejected the whole race of Israel until he had cast them out of his sight. 2 Kings 17:19 following.